Welcome to Statewide Reports and Conversations from in and around Illinois. I'm Sean Crawford. This hour, a problem for many rural areas. Baby boomers are retiring, and many of the businesses they've kept operating through the years have nobody to take over. We'll have a report on what some call a silver tsunami. Rural homelessness is a growing issue. Most counties lack the social infrastructure to tackle it. We'll talk with some advocates about what's needed. A high school student helped draft a bill that now awaits the governor's signature. We'll also have more on a program that can help more people with life experience graduate from college and learn how runoff from farm fields is impacting rivers. And we'll also visit with those working to keep some of the most scenic spots in southern Illinois cleaned up. Those stories and more this hour on Statewide. This is Statewide. I'm Sean Crawford. Longtime small business owners from the baby boomer generation are reaching retirement age, but many struggle to find someone who's willing to buy the business and keep it running. Brian Beach reports on how the wave of retirements is hitting rural communities especially hard.
Stratton, Nebraska is a quiet town. The village has no school, one gas station, and is surrounded by farm and ranch land. Late last year, the town's lone lumberyard and hardware store, League Builders Supply, closed. Owner Dennis League was really ready to retire, but he feels some guilt about shutting down the business.
I'm not going to say Stratton's going to shrivel up and die because I'm not here, but I don't think it's going to help anything. And I feel bad about that. But there's a point where you got to take care of yourself, and I think I'm there.
Leek put the business up for sale more than a year ago in hopes of keeping a lumberyard in Stratton, but none of the few interested buyers could make it work in such a small community. Longtime resident 85-year-old Lauren Agel remembers when the village was thriving and Leek was able to employ up to 9 people at the lumberyard.
Back in them days, it was a different environment. The problem is we just don't have no people left. I mean, that's a whole town's problem.
The village had a population of more than 600 in 1950. Today, it's less than half that. Many other towns across the rural Great Plains and the Midwest have experienced similar losses. Young people migrating to larger cities and leaving behind aging populations are contributing to those losses, according to Ness Sandoval, a sociology professor at St. Louis University.
In rural areas, you tend to see more people dying than are born. And that has to do with, you know, the brain drain, young people leaving, going to college, and not necessarily coming back home.
For the businesses that remain in towns like Stratton, it can be difficult for owners to find younger buyers once they're ready to retire. Renee Wyatt, a research specialist with the North Central Regional Center for Rural Development at Purdue University in Indiana, says the situation is reflected throughout rural America, and things are likely to get worse.
There's a silver tsunami coming. So there's basically going to be this mass exodus, right, of that baby boomer age who are going to all be retiring in the next 5 to 10 years.
In fact, a 2023 study from the Exit Planning Institute found that 75% of business owners would like to exit their businesses within the next 10 years. In Moran, Kansas, population 466, the sole grocery store is Marmaton Market. General manager and part owner Marilyn Logan is nearing 80, but has no plans on retiring soon.
I'm going to be here until they wheel me out to the ambulance in my chair.
However, Logan is looking to hire someone to help her manage the grocery store and lighten her current workload of 60 to 80 hour weeks. That process hasn't been easy in the southeast Kansas town.
We need younger people, but we need younger people with skills. We don't have people in the town that are young enough to work that have the skills to work, and they're not interested in learning.
Without an ability to hire enough employees, selling a business can become even more challenging. At Vitali's Italian Restaurant and Pizzeria in Macomb, Illinois, Julie Dienst says her 86-year-old mom and older brother want to retire, but the longest-running single-owned restaurant in town is already short-staffed.
So it's real labor-intensive. It's more responsibilities falling on fewer people. So with more people retiring, you know, it's a real heavy load.
2 years ago, the family decided to try to sell the business. But Macomb, the home of Western Illinois University, has lost a quarter of its population and is facing declining university enrollment. Dienst says that's made it a challenging market.
There are already several restaurants that are empty. So, I mean, having one more restaurant for sale, even though we're not closed like these other places, is just more competition, I guess.
Dienst says the family's restaurant has seen generations of customers come through their doors. And that, she says, is hard to put a price on. For Harvest Public Media, I'm Brian Beach.
Western Illinois University recently laid off 36 non-tenure track faculty members to cut expenses, but it still has a lot of work to do to close the gap between its spending and revenue. Rich Egger reports.
The layoffs will save the university around $3 million, but interim president Dr. Christy Mindrup says Western's budget gap is much larger than that.
Our deficit is right at about $20 million at this point.
Mindrup says the goal is to present a balanced budget to Western's Board of Trustees when the board meets in late September. And she says they want to minimize the impact on personnel while striving for the desired goal of financial stability. But
if these layoffs save you maybe around $3 million and you have a $20 million hole and 80% of your expenses are with personnel, are more layoffs in the offing?
It's too soon to answer that question because our team continues to evaluate and look at our financial situation with the start of the fiscal year. We know that through those financial measures, including reducing costs, operational efficiency, looking for external funding and focus on student retention, we know that we're about 60% of the way there with the plans that are ever evolving. And so probably within a month or so, I would have a better answer to what degree these additional measures will affect personnel.
Mindrup says Western can save money through attrition, that is, by not filling positions as workers retire or leave for other jobs. She says they've also reduced the number of administrative positions. There are now 4 vice presidents instead of 5, and she streamlined duties to reduce the number of assistant vice presidents. Mindrup says the administration will continue to evaluate where it makes sense to consolidate programs. They're also reviewing various contracts.
For example, previously we had looked at an outside consultant to look at our academic programs, and we decided to discontinue that for total savings of, I think that was around $400,000 that we'll be saving over the next 2 years.
That consultant was brought in under the administration of Western's previous president, Dr. Guiyu Huang. He resigned after 3 years on the job, and Mindrup took over as interim president in April. The layoffs are not playing well with faculty. Merrill Cole is president of the WIU chapter of the University Professionals of Illinois, which represents faculty. Cole says he knew layoffs were coming, but UPI is not happy about them.
We do not like what's happened. We do not want our members to suffer, and they are suffering right now.
Cole says, for example, some who've lost their job are wondering how they will pay for their prescription medicine. He says UPI is doing what it can to help. Cole is not sold on the $20 million deficit figure.
There are different ways of defining what a deficit is. There are different ways of defining how far behind we are. There are different ways of seeing what needs to be done.
Despite that and the layoffs, Cole believes he can work with Mindrup, and he's feeling some hope after the administration and UPI leadership met following the layoffs announcement.
I think that everybody in that room is committed to building a better WIU. We don't agree on a lot of things, and we certainly don't agree about the layoffs. But I want to believe, I have every reason to believe that we're all trying to make WIU a better place, most especially for our students.
Cole says Western has a long-term mission of lifting up students and improving their social mobility. He says the commitment is there from both sides of the table to fulfill that mission. There might be some assistance coming from the state, according to Democratic State Senator Mike Halpin. His district includes both of Western's campuses, which are in Macomb and Moline. Halpin says for the first time in more than 10 years, the state is funding a grant for Illinois veterans. He says the state requires public universities to accept veterans tuition-free, but for many years it has not reimbursed universities for those costs.
So this year we put $6 million into the budget to partially reimburse those costs. And institutions like Western Illinois University are going to disproportionately benefit because of the number of veterans that we serve here.
Halpin says Western will also receive a $500,000 grant this fiscal year for recruitment and retention programs. Further down the road, Western could benefit from a change in the way the state funds higher education. Halpin says the state's Higher Education Funding Commission is recommending something akin to what the state has done for K-12 education with an evidence-based funding formula.
Where we take into account, you know, more the size of the school, the makeup of the student body, the needs of underrepresented students, rural students, and put those into a formula to make sure that we're giving universities enough money to meet the mission, you know, as determined by the student body.
Legislation to do so has not been introduced, and any such plan won't help Western with its current budget shortfall. The school also faces a drop in enrollment. The administration projects Western will have between 5,500 and 6,000 students this fall, a drop from 7,000 a year ago. Interim President Mindrup says there are state and regional institutions across the country that have turned the corner, and the administration is looking at them for ideas while recognizing it needs to present a balanced budget to the Board of Trustees by the end of September.
There are plans that you make when quick action is needed, and there's plans that you make when, you know, you have 5 years to plan. We want to do those simultaneously. So while we need to address the immediate budget situation, we also want to position ourselves for a healthy future as well.
What that might look like is the task the administration will be focused on in the months ahead. Rich Egger reporting.
Nearly 40 million adults across the country have some college credit but no degree. A unique program at Northeastern Illinois University helps people cross the finish line, giving them credit for life experience. But financial challenges mean the program serves only a handful of students. Lisa Curry and Phillip has more.
Murray Uwase Adams just biked home from work in 90-degree plus weather, so she's opted to sit inside with the AC on blast.
I'm not tired, just really, like, heated up. You know, I feel like an oven.
Uwase Adams has lived in Chicago for more than two decades. She came to the States as a refugee from Rwanda before the genocide there in the 90s.
We came because I knew, we know the war was getting worse, but we had no idea what it would come to.
Uwase Adams lost both her brother and mom in the violence there. And her refugee status meant that a few weeks after starting college in the States, she found out she was not eligible for financial aid, and she couldn't afford to pay for tuition out of pocket.
I walked out of that financial aid office and I never went back to class.
Eventually, Uwase Adams got a job in healthcare and worked her way up. But despite taking on more responsibility, she could not get a promotion or raise.
Because of my lack of education and just not having a diploma, I kind of hit a plateau of how far I could go with the company and the things I was allowed to do and the rooms I was allowed to sit in.
Uwase Adams knew going back to school would help. But after that horrible feeling of dropping out the first time, the 40-something-year-old felt college wasn't for her.
And I was like, well, I guess this is where I'm going to be the rest of my life until I found this program.
This program is the University Without Walls at Northeastern Illinois University. It's based on a model that's been around since the 1970s and is designed specifically for students like Uwase Adams.
For those people who are like, oh, what do I bring to the table? I only have this many credits. And it's like, well, you started your own business over that time, or you raised a family, or you advocated for your disabled child.
Lisa Modinos has written about the University Without Walls approach and teaches at the only other remaining program in the country in Massachusetts. Students who enroll work with a faculty advisor to craft their work and life experience into a narrative portfolio. Modino says, besides helping them earn a degree, it changes how students feel about their time away from school.
You have and bring so much knowledge, and we're going to honor it, integrate it, and help you reframe how you see yourself and your knowledge and your history, and give you a college degree with that knowledge embedded in it.
Through Northeastern's program, Uwase Adams' work at a COVID testing site turned into science credit. Her experience taking calls on a domestic violence hotline became communications coursework. She was able to finish her bachelor's degree in just 2 years. Her graduation was in May.
I sat next to a woman who was like in her 60s, and she said, I've been working for this for 40 years trying to get a degree. And I asked her, like, what are you going to do now? She's like, I'm going to go to grad school.
The program was a game changer for Uwase Adams and her classmate, and could be a game changer for many more. But the approach requires a lot of one-on-one advising. That takes resources, and Northeastern doesn't have a lot. So this program that could change lives, it only serves 10 to 20 students at a time. Zeta Johnson, who helps oversee it, wishes they could serve more.
That becomes a challenge when you have such a high demand and you have a small shop.
Johnson says meeting that demand would require more state and federal funding. Lisa Corian Phillip, WBEZ News.
We'll talk about rural homelessness. That's on the way on Statewide.
We're back on Statewide. I'm Sean Crawford. Rural homelessness is a growing issue nationwide, and in central Illinois, most counties don't have the social services infrastructure to support people in need. Several counties don't have homeless shelters. Agencies say there is a growing need to build them as the homeless population continues to climb. In the meantime, staff are left to find Band-Aid solutions. Melissa Ellen spoke to people on the front lines in the fight to end homelessness about how they make use of the little resources they have.
Livingston County is seeing an unprecedented rise in the number of people homeless or on the brink of it. Numbers hit a record high in recent months, with 30 people identified as homeless countywide. That includes men, women, and children. Deb Howard is the director of United Way in Livingston County. She says there aren't enough resources for people to get back on their feet.
This has kind of become like an epidemic, where we definitely need something. I don't know what the answer is, but we need something.
Part of the problem is that Livingston County doesn't have a homeless shelter. Neither do most of the rural counties in the region, and it's becoming a strain on their already limited resources to find innovative ways to help people without them. Howard says Livingston County used to have no trouble sending people to other counties if a homeless shelter was needed.
And now we are, because they have their own issues.
Bloomington's two shelters have been full for months. Matt Burgess is the CEO of Home Sweet Home Ministries, which operates the Mission Shelter. He says Bloomington is lucky to have the homeless services network that it does. Most small cities and towns are like Pontiac, with few people able to support the homeless community.
The reality is there just aren't enough resources to have smaller shelters in all of the little towns in the rural area. It's just such a costly way of trying to provide support to people.
Caroline McLeese with Salvation Army Pontiac 360 Life Center says it may be the best option right now. She's starting to keep close track of the people in Livingston County who are homeless in the hopes of generating convincing data for people who are skeptical that rural homelessness exists in the area.
Nobody keeps track of these people, and it's That's my goal. I'm starting to keep track. I want to report this. I want to let everybody know this is what's going on. This is what we need help with. And I'm just hoping out of that, somebody's going to say, I'll help you.
The hum in the background is a refrigerator. I met with McLeese and the director of operations for Pontiac Salvation Army in the food pantry. They were short-staffed that day and had to help people in the pantry and the attached shop while we spoke. Director Tina Hammer says she and McLeese both want a shelter in Pontiac, but getting one won't be easy.
Even if we were able to secure a shelter today, it would probably be a 3-year plan before something was able to house anyone, which is a sad process between getting the funding and getting the building and getting the staff and everything else.
In the meantime, McLeese says the situation is bleak. Many homeless people find temporary housing with friends and family or in local motels that allow for long stays. If neither of those work out, there are Airbnbs. McLeese says these are typically outside people's budgets at around $600 per month, and even Salvation Army struggles to fund the people staying in them. But they make it work because the only other option is for people to live on the streets.
I don't think a lot of this community who has not experienced this realizes just how truly bad it is and that something has to be done about it.
There are several reasons why people are increasingly becoming precariously housed, and it's not an issue isolated to Pontiac or Central Illinois. Deb Howard with Livingston County United Way says the bottom line is that the cost of living is too high. It's gotten to the point where employed people can't pay their bills.
We have working people that are living in cars that hold jobs.
Howard says these people fall outside the income threshold for most federal aid programs, making it more difficult to help them. Permanent supportive housing is also not available. Howard says affordable housing is part of the solution, but it takes years to build and millions to fund. She's not sure what solution there might be in the meantime.
How long can we put people up in hotels when there's no housing here? You know, it's almost like Band-Aids on everything. It's putting fires out and sticking Band-Aids on everything and no fix.
Several other counties surrounding Bloomington Normal are in the same boat as Livingston County. There are a handful of staff at a handful of agencies working to find temporary solutions to rural homelessness. Rachel Oney is one of two case managers at the Salvation Army 360 Life Center in Lincoln, which oversees 8 rural counties. None have shelters, and the closest ones are in bigger cities 45 minutes away.
Springfield, Champaign, Decatur, Pekin, Peoria. Any direction, we're like, pick a point and you can find a big city. But right around us are also a lot of rural counties.
Oney says the best way area service providers have found to help people who are homeless within those counties is to collaborate. She works closely with the Community Action Partnership of Central Illinois to figure out how each organization can fill in the gaps left by the other's funding limitations.
There's no reason that you should have to go to 3 different agencies to find what you're looking for. If we all know what each other are doing, then we can connect people a lot faster.
This type of collaboration also helps the organizations better combat additional rural challenges, such as a lack of transportation. It's also led to an exciting possibility for Lincoln, getting its first homeless shelter. A nonprofit is hoping to get building renovations done on the shelter in the next 3 months. At that point, it can start opening up beds to unsheltered people throughout Logan County and its neighbors. Kim Turner chairs the board of the nonprofit. She says it will work with the Salvation Army and others to coordinate wraparound services, because having a shelter is only a first step.
Obviously, having a roof over your head is extremely important, but it's not everything. It doesn't fix all of your problems. So we want to be able to address those problems for overall stability.
Brandy Gerber in Woodford County knows firsthand how hard it can be to strike that balance. She works at the county's only homeless shelter called Heart House. It has 6 rooms for women and children only. She says they don't serve men because there are women fleeing domestic violence who stay there. They do serve men, though, at Heartline, which is their financial assistance arm. Gerber says there need to be more agencies offering help.
Is there enough resources for the homeless population in Woodford County? And I'm going to say no. And it's not just a service providing shelter, it's other supportive services.
Gerber says Woodford County has to rely on Peoria often, including for mental health and public aid opportunities, since Woodford County lacks both. Peoria is about 20 miles away from Eureka, the Woodford County seat. Gerber says she understands that bigger communities such as Bloomington Normal and Peoria have more people who are homeless, but it makes the rural places like Eureka less appealing for funding.
If I presented a grant for public transportation and Peoria submitted a grant for public transportation, who would win that? It would be Peoria, because they're able to show more numbers of people that would be utilizing those services.
Gerber says getting public transportation is critical for getting people better connected to services in Woodford County, but it feels like a dream, just like Salvation Army staff in Livingston feel about getting a shelter. Matt Burgess at Home Sweet Home Ministry Shelter in Bloomington says it's up to each community to find what works for them.
One of the things that my experience has taught me is that when a community really has a will to accomplish something, they find ways to make it happen. It might not look like it does in other communities, but solutions start to rise to the surface that maybe weren't recognized before.
And agencies agree the need for solutions is clearer than ever before. They just have to get the right people on board. I'm Melissa Ellen.
A Republican delegate from Tazewell County says the Republican National Convention energized Illinois Republicans beyond just support for Donald Trump. Diane Jordan is vice president for the group Illinois Federation of Republican Women. She told Eric Stock that Trump's running mate choice, J.D. Vance, will attract the next generation of Republican voters.
The young people are, there's so many of them that are on the Trump train already, and I'm excited about that. That's what we're trying to get going here, in Tazewell County, is bring along this younger generation. My kids are just hitting their 30s. And they're the ones that are going to be the leaders of this country in the future. And they are getting excited, and they are understanding what needs to start happening. And I'm excited about that. And so not only does my generation, are they involved, but my mom in her 70s is involved. So now I have three generations of us that are wanting to be knowledgeable and wanting to be involved. And yeah, the younger generation, they're picking up steam. I'm excited about it.
One of the points of hesitation, it sounds like, from Republicans in Vance's selection at first was he had been one of the most outspoken Republicans against Trump when he first came onto the scene back about 7-8 years ago. Used some pretty strong language against him. What do you make of that transformation, and is that something that you can look back on now and be fine with?
Oh, I'm absolutely fine with that. I mean, that was 7 or 8 years ago. I look at my kids who, like I said, are hitting their 30s. 7 or 8 years ago, come on. They have totally different opinions of things now. They've matured. They've grown. They've learned things. They've made decisions that are different than what they would have made back then. Absolutely. He can make changes. He's allowed to have his opinions 8 years ago, but they can be different 8 years from then. So I'm absolutely okay with that.
Mm-hmm. I know you've been a Trump supporter from the beginning. The head of the Illinois GOP, who had recently resigned, pointed to some power struggles within the party, and it seemed to be between the fiscally conservative sort of donor class and the Trump wing of the party, and Trump clearly has won that. Where does the party go from here after the 2022 election cycle that in Illinois did not go as well as Republicans had hoped?
Well, I think in Illinois, the Republicans, we're really working on that unity right now. We need to come together, and we all need to support President Trump. He is going to be the nominee for president. And so we need to work on bringing all of us together to support our presidential candidate, because we're not just voting for Trump as a person. We're voting for the Second Amendment. We're voting for the veterans. We're voting for the military, secure borders, all of those things. We're not just voting for Trump. So we all need to come together and work towards unity and build the Illinois Republicans to a stronger force.
It seems a lot of the numbers in a lot of the issues Republicans have pulled well in, but the party still seems to be struggling to find a unified message on abortion and women's health. Roe seemed to have a big impact on the midterms 2 years ago. As a female leader in the Republican Party, how do you think the GOP should approach the abortion issue this year?
Now, that's a tougher question. Of course, everyone's entitled to their beliefs on that one. But my personal belief, I'm not going to go into, But I do believe that as Republicans, we can all come to a mutual understanding of it. If you look at our platform, it speaks to that on there. And that's all I would like to say to that one.
That's Tazewell County Republican Delegate Diane Jordan. She spoke with Eric Stock during the Republican National Convention. A Naperville high school student named Grace Kelly created and helped write a bill now awaiting the governor's signature. It will require all Illinois students learn about climate change. Peter Medlin talked with her about what the bill means for future students.
It gives students a foundation on climate change and shows them how like they can take action.
So action's a big part of it too.
Yeah, it's more just like showing how they can have solutions included in it.
When we have conversations about climate change, it can feel very, very overwhelming. So it is nice to have a solutions point of that so we don't just end off the lesson in total kind of existential despair.
I think it can be more doom and gloom, and having those solutions is really important for students so that they know they can actually feel motivated to go out and take action. You know, that could be in their career, you know, as a climate activist, but like it could be for just like any student.
Where did the idea for this come from? I saw that it started from research that you did with the Illinois Global Scholar Program last year. Really quick, can you tell people a bit about the research that you got to do as part of that?
I felt, you know, unsatisfied with the amount of education on climate change. I feel like there's very little.
And there was some research that you did as part of it too, right?
Yeah, you know, I found that like most people want climate change education, most students do, and I found that it was important that climate change education was integrated in different courses.
How do you get from the idea for this to actually getting a bill going in the General Assembly?
It was a lot of research first, you know, like it wasn't first off, I'm going and doing a law. It was like a lot of what is the best solution for this? And it just happened to lead me towards like that path. And, you know, I reached out to Representative Janet Yang Rohr and connected with her chief of staff. And we kind of went back and forth on drafting this bill, you know, with my kind of idea of having it integrated and also having some aspect of student action, which I think are still true to how it has been moved, you know, to today. But it seemed like approachable that I could do that. You know, I feel like I was very fortunate in that Janet Yang Rohr's team let me work on this bill and like draft it together. But it was still like quite a bit of like persistence and also like being flexible and like working with the different stakeholders and people. So
how did you find out that it passed? What was that kind of feeling like?
It like took a while, like when I was watching it in the Senate and the House, like it took a while, like it kept passing it. And I was just, I kept just having it on and like listening to the whole, like, cause it takes like a while for them to like get through all the bills. So like I was just waiting, and then I was in school for like a lot of them. So like I couldn't watch them always, but like when it passed, I think it was in school, and my parents were like, it passed, cause they found out. So, and then it was just exciting. It's very exciting news.
What advice would you have for, you know, like other high school students who have an idea or think they might want to do something similar?
Research as much as you can and what is the best solution. You know, legislation might not be the best solution for what you're looking at. And then through that, you probably will find people that you can connect with, and they will probably guide you, hopefully. But I'd say stay persistent, stay curious too, and ask questions, and just keep going on whatever you're passionate about.
That's Grace Kelly, a recent Neuqua Valley High School grad. She talked with Peter Medlin about the climate change education plan she proposed and helped pass through the General Assembly. The cause of a massive sinkhole in an Alton park that formed above a mine last month is still officially unknown. Will Bauer reports there is a preliminary theory.
Alton Mayor David Goins says the initial finding from the U.S. Mine Safety and Health Administration blames the sinkhole on an underground cave.
MSHA determined the cause of the mine subsidence was buildup of mud and other sediment in an ancient cave in the mine, which eventually collapsed, creating the sinkhole.
But the CEO of New Frontier Materials, the mine company, says he's unaware of those preliminary findings. And with the help of MSHA, the company will continue to drill to confirm the cause. The park remains closed. Eventually, the sinkhole will be filled in. Goen says the legal teams for the city and the company are still working out who will pay for the repairs. In Alton, I'm Will Bauer.
More to come on Statewide. Stay right here. This is Statewide. I'm Sean Crawford. Wheelchairs may seem straightforward to use until you need to move up and down hills or curbs. Around 3.7 million people use a wheelchair in the U.S., but some are not taught the advanced skills in physical therapy. Side Effects Public Media's Elizabeth Gabriel reports on a free program in Indianapolis that helps young children glide through everyday life.
Savannah Helton is 12 years old. She has spina bifida, which means that her spine didn't form properly. She needs a wheelchair, and lately, she's been practicing how to do wheelies.
It's basically where you push two times, and then you pop into your wheelie. So that way, if you're going up like a curb, you can get into your wheelie so you can go up the hill or the curb or wherever you're going.
Savannah is part of an Indiana University program called Skills on Wheels. Kids spend multiple days in a gym learning how to navigate using props like ramps and curbs. But today's the day they practice those new skills outside in an everyday setting. Tony Chase is the program director of Skills on Wheels. He says a child's confidence takes a big hit if they don't know how to use their wheelchair. Kids may decide to skip certain activities at school or with friends if they know there will be obstacles like narrow doors or stairs.
We would love to change the world and just make it all of a sudden accessible, but that's a little bit too lofty of a goal. So instead, let's try to make kids more confident in navigating this inaccessible world.
Researchers have developed a list of core skills that are essential for navigating a wheelchair in a variety of environments. But kids might not learn these skills in school or even physical or occupational therapy. Maria Fuchs is an occupational therapist volunteering with the program. She says she didn't learn a lot about hands-on wheelchair training during grad school.
A lot of times, wheelchair training isn't like a main focus. It is something that can get funded, but a lot of times other things like feeding or dressing or play skills, things like that, are kind of the priority.
She says kids often just learn the basics, like using the wheel locks and how to take the wheelchair apart. And that's if their insurance covers it. Kiri Morgan is a researcher at Washington University in St. Louis. She says some people might have a wheelchair, but their insurance won't reimburse them for rehab to learn how to use it.
There's this gap in education. There's this gap in actually having the environment in the medical model where clinicians know how to justify it in their notes so that health insurance pays for it.
That's why Morgan says it's common for wheelchair users to learn new skills through other people with disabilities or watching online videos. But that isn't always accessible or safe.
What did you work on so far? Let's recap.
Two of those hills.
Going down the hill.
And going up the hill.
And going up the hill. And then...
I'm just going to say wheelie because I can't remember.
The Skills on Wheels program is also a chance for kids to socialize with others in wheelchairs, something that doesn't happen often in Savannah's small town of Kokomo. And for Savannah, mingling means chatting about her absolute favorite show that's actually roughly twice her age.
After this, we're taking a talking about Grey's Anatomy break.
I like it. I think it's been well earned.
You're doing a good job, kiddo.
Now they're back to practicing, but large wheelchairs are heavy. That's why Savannah's mom, Chanda Helton, holds onto a strap that connects to the back of her daughter's wheelchair so it's safe for Savannah to practice wheelies. The program isn't just helpful for Savannah. It allows Helton to learn proper techniques in case the wheelchair starts to tip backwards.
It's amazing. First time I watched her, I had tears in my eyes. And I'm like, oh my gosh, that's my baby girl.
She's not a baby anymore. How are you?
Savannah and her parents plan to come back next year. In the meantime, she hopes the program will also have guest appearances from some of the Grey's Anatomy characters to help encourage the kids.
I just said, like, Patrick Dempsey, his character is one of my favorite characters.
Elizabeth Gabriel, Side Effects Public Media.
It's called the Dead Zone, a massive area of the Gulf of Mexico, so low in oxygen that fish and other aquatic life can't live there. Roughly 70% of harmful nutrients that cause the dead zone come from farms in the Midwest, namely fertilizer, and climate change is only making the runoff worse. Without specific laws to regulate the use of fertilizer, farmers are left to make changes on their own, but many don't. Mississippi River Basin Ag and Water Desk contributor Eric Schmidt reports on why.
Doug Downs farms about 2,000 acres of corn and soybeans in central Illinois. A few years ago, a farm next door to his was for sale. It was a public auction, and up on a board were numbers of how much that farm had produced each year.
I hate to say it like this, they were shockingly low for the type of farm they were in the area.
The farm was known to use cover crops in the off-season, plants like cereal rye or wheat, which can soak up nutrients like nitrogen and keep them from running off and polluting the water. Downs had long been curious if cover crops could work on his fields, but these numbers...
I'm like, holy cow. There's no way I could make that work.
Downs isn't against cover crops. He's used them for years, and these days about 15 to 20% of his fields have them. But
I can't use them everywhere. I can't lose money for the sake of growing a cover crop.
So Downs does what many Midwestern farmers do. He uses additional fertilizer for the corn he grows.
I need that nitrogen. I gotta have it.
It's this nitrogen that's causing the dead zone in the Gulf of Mexico. And U.S. Secretary of Agriculture Tom Vilsack says some farmers are even using more of it than they need to.
Many of our corn acres are being over-fertilized.
The reason is most farmers are focused on growing as much corn and soy as they can each year, so says Jay Arbuckle, a rural sociologist at Iowa State University who has surveyed hundreds of farmers over the past 25 years. They tell him it's all about their bottom line.
You know, if I'm not economically sustainable in the short term, there's no way I can be environmentally sustainable in the long term.
What some farmers may not realize, Arbuckle says, is that cover crops make more nitrogen available in the soil, which means farmers could spend less money on additional fertilizer. This would make their profits bigger and put fewer pollutants in the water. But it could take years before an operation like that becomes profitable, years that many farmers simply can't afford. Arbuckle says this is the result of a decades-old system that rewards farmers for growing as much as they can, regardless of the consequences.
Farmers are now saying, well, we've done what you asked us to do, and now we're being asked to do something different. How do I get there?
One program that's answering that question is Precision Conservation Management, which is run by the Illinois Corn Growers Association. It uses government and private money to pay farmers to try things like cover crops or no-till farming, which can reduce the need for extra nitrogen. And these practices can produce crops that could then be marketed as better for the environment. Ed Decker, who also farms corn and soy in central Illinois, recently signed up. He says while he and other farmers value their independence, it is nice to get paid to try something new.
It's a double-edged sword. Honestly, we kind of need to be doing it on our own if that's the right thing to do in the long term.
The program is still pretty small. Only a fraction of Illinois farmers are enrolled. The idea is to get farmers to change now, before the federal or state government steps in to regulate them. Doug Downs expects this will happen, that farmers like him will eventually be required to use more cover crops and less synthetic fertilizers. He says he'll try anything that could help him do that. It just has to make sense for his bottom line.
We're not providing a service. I mean, I hate to say it like that. I'm here to make a living. My definition of sustainability is staying in business and putting my kids through school and making my mortgage payments and making my farm payments. You know, I certainly don't want to pollute my water.
For now, Downs says he will use less fertilizer next year and see if he can figure out how to make it and other sustainable farming practices work for him in the future. I'm Eric Schmidt.
The natural beauty of southern Illinois stands out in the state, but not everyone is taking care of the natural wonders, leaving behind trash. Ethan Holder reports.
The glistening water of Lake of Egypt invites all to take the boat out for a spin. The bright light emanating at the end of the Tunnel Hill Tunnel urges you to keep going. The lush trails, full of trees and steep hills, offer never-ending possibilities at Ripple Hollow. These are just some of the natural beauties located in southern Illinois. However, their beauty is being covered up by mounds of filth.
And when they came out here, they found over 2,000 pounds of trash. And that consisted of really large things like tires and stoves that we've had to pull out of the ravine, to tiny little cigarette butts that we pick up off the ground or broken up pieces of plastic. Like when you came in today, I don't know if you noticed, someone dropped a pin on the ground, and now that's been driven over and shattered into bunch of micro trash, tiny little plastic particles that we will now pick up. Last year when we came out here, there wasn't as many tires, but there was 2 garbage bags full of dirty diapers that had been sitting out here collecting rainwater.
That was Ann Townsend, the Extension Program Coordinator of University of Illinois's Natural Resources, Environment, and Energy team. All of the trash has been dumped throughout the natural wonders of Southern Illinois, but Townsend and other organizations are doing what they can to bring the beauty back to the region. U of I's Extension and the Friends of the Shawnee National Forest have gotten together for many years to host trash blasts, which lead a group of volunteers to find whatever rubbish in nature they could get their hands on. Townsend says she loves nature, but she doesn't do these events solely for herself.
You can see I have a child. I enjoy the outdoors. I want to be able to go out into nature and be able to see it in its beauty. I want to be able to maintain the ecosystem that is here, that exists, that makes Southern Illinois so rich for my children and other locals to be able to enjoy it and other people. Our area is just so beautiful and so different than other places, and I would like to see it stay that way.
Her appreciation for the land led to her efforts in picking up garbage around Southern Illinois. Over the past 3 years, the trash blasts have removed over 7,000 pounds of trash from the region, with the most recent endeavor at Ripple Hollow collecting over 500 pounds. This seems meager compared to the 2,000 pounds collected in 2022, but Townsend says this is amazing to see.
It's gone pretty good. I would say overall the trash has been down this year from last year, so that's always really exciting for us to see, like our efforts are doing something. But very successful when you look at it collectively as many people have come out, and we're still making an impact on the forest.
None of this could be possible without the volunteers who show up and work together to keep their homes in the best state it can be in.
Are you going to get that up the hill?
Well, we're going
to try. One step at a time.
We're getting there.
Many of the volunteers, including Joe Littleton, have been caring about nature for decades.
I hated seeing the trash everywhere when we fished at Kentucky Lake. Everything that floated up in the back of the bays where we were fishing, I just hated it. And I wanted to pick it all up, but my dad wouldn't let me because it's going to disturb the fishing. So I would get off on the bank and I would go pick up a bag of trash on my walk back to the truck, even back whenever I was 10, 12 years old, I think.
Being outdoors with his father growing up gave him a personal connection with nature that knew no bounds. He both admired nature and did what he could to give back to it. Sometimes, however, he would find things that could range from disturbing to even dangerous.
The things that I hate is needles in parks. I geocache, so where we would go try to find geocaches, crawl underneath a bridge and find actually a stash of drugs within sight of where the cache was. Find needles laying around where kids are heading in to play in playgrounds. I've hated seeing those, and I've seen those in Western Kentucky, Southern Illinois, Missouri, and even in Virginia when we cached out there. Hate seeing those things.
Many people have stepped up to display their passion for nature by cleaning up their local trails and parks, but more volunteers would never hurt. Ann Townsend invites anyone with a love for nature or who just wants to meet people in their community to join her when the trash blasts start back up this September.
You know, I think that these events are like something really amazing, and it's really great. We get to see people from all over. Like this event today, we have people from Kentucky, people from Indiana, and people from Illinois have all come together just to pick up trash. And it's something that can be done everywhere and anywhere. So, you know, if you're looking for a way to meet new people and get out in the woods or get out in your local parks, like this is a great opportunity. See if you can reach out to whoever manages that land to host something like this, because there's trash everywhere. And we can all do a small thing to make a big impact.
Many people come from all over the Midwest with all different backgrounds and reasons for investing their time as a volunteer, but they all have the same goals in mind.
So I think it's different for everyone, but that's pretty much what it all comes back to, is wanting to care for the land and making sure that others get to experience the beauty and the majesty of what we have here.
I'm Ethan Holder.
We're out of time for Statewide. Thanks for being along and join us next week. We'll be back with more reports and conversations from in and around Illinois. Find us where you get your podcasts through the NPR app and at nprillinois.org, as well as this station's website. I'm Sean Crawford. Statewide is a production of NPR Illinois with help from other Illinois public radio stations.